There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. The shows are coming a little faster these days, now that I don't have a whole lot of other activities and no travel plans in the near future. With me today, I have two guests. First is Suzanne Hobbs-Baker, the creative director at the Fastest Path to Zero, an initiative hosted at the University of Michigan, which is a multidisciplinary approach to determining a way to get to zero carbon emissions in the fastest possible way. The second guest is Steve Applin, a consultant to the Canadian nuclear industry. Both Susie and Steve have been guests on the Atomic Show before, so you'll recognize their voices. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be
here. Thanks, Rod.
And what I'd like to start off this conversation with, partly because Susie has a time constraint, is we want to introduce what Fastest Path, or introduce Atomic Show listeners to what Fastest Path to Zero is, what they've been doing already, and what they plan to do in the near future. So Susie, why don't you start off with that?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Rod. I always appreciate the chance to reconnect with you and to update on some of the cool research that we're doing. Basically, this initiative, it's hosted at the University of Michigan, and it's a joint effort between the Nuclear Engineering Department and the Energy Institute there, which is sort of like an academic think tank. And it started because my longtime mentor, Todd Allen, accepted the role of department chair. And I had been working with him for years and years, previously at Third Way and at INL. And during that time, I had been doing a ton of research and trying to understand through a sort of the lens of cultural theory, why some people love nuclear, why some people hate nuclear, and why some people aren't really activated by it as an issue and are kind of neutral on it. And through that process, I started to realize that this wasn't just a PR problem, right? Like, this was deeper than that. And I got into a lot of sort of sociology literature and realized that, you know, this is more of a socio-technical problem. This is something that touches on technology, geography, politics, social issues, economics, and the decision-making with regard to energy, and specifically nuclear, is really complex. And I realized we didn't have a very good working framework for grappling with the level of complexity that we're really dealing with. That's just a PR problem, or that's just an economic problem. And it's like, well, wait, all of those problems also matter, right? And so I sort of wanted to dig deeper and start to think about how we integrate all of those different factors in a way that helps us get to better outcomes, particularly with regard to the deployment of advanced reactors. So I think we probably all share the view that we absolutely need advanced nuclear for climate change. And it's kind of like this inflection point. So basically, we have the opportunity to shake things up a lot because the technology is so different that we can change things like our business models or how we finance things or how people engage in social contexts. Certainly tons of people are working on changing the economics of these plants. So I realized that the timing was really good to do this research. So about a year ago, I transitioned over to Michigan and started digging into this, or this series of questions. And basically, what we've done so far is we've built, and please jump in with any questions, because I'm just going to like go on and on.
I am going to jump in right now, since you gave me the option. One of the things that I've heard about this fastest path to zero that I really like is the fact that it's an interdisciplinary approach and spreads across the campus, and not, it's not something that's focused in just engineering or just sociology or whatever. It has people from all over the campus. Is that a correct impression?
That's right. So we have like an advisory committee of experts across disciplines and across the whole campus who help us think through different aspects of the work. So we've got everyone from architects to social justice scholars to renewable energy scholars and experts. So, you know, we're learning from other fields, we're learning from other technology arenas, and we're trying to integrate sort of the very best thinking from a lot of different corners of academia into the way that we're thinking about advanced reactor deployment.
And yeah, what are the, I'm going to jump in again. Started with architects, and I was impressed to see that there was an article about an advanced reactor in Architectural Digest this last week. The Oklo powerhouse was featured, so it was pretty, it maybe they have something to do with you, I don't know.
I definitely encouraged, I have encouraged all of the advanced nuclear companies that I interact with to take design seriously. And I would say Oklo has taken that to heart. And I think they always, from the get-go, set out to create something beautiful and iconic. So I did play a little bit of a role helping to connect them with some designers and things like that. But really, I've been very impressed with how they've been thinking about it on their own as well. But yeah, I think it's just, it's the type of thing that shows that you care, right? It may seem like an extra step, but it actually can be transformative in some of these different arenas that we're talking about that aren't just technology based. So in the context of social acceptance, design can be an incredibly helpful tool for getting people excited and involved, creating opportunities for people to think about how the technology might fit into their communities. And that's, Rod, that's really at the heart of the research that we're doing right now. One of the things that we've done in the past as the nuclear sector that we're really trying to interrogate is this idea of just like network-based deployment strategies. Like, oh, well, I know a guy in this area who's really excited, or this utility has a long history with nuclear, or this, that, and the other, and having sort of a single network-based factor determine where resources go or where projects go. That hasn't bode well for us historically. And so using a framework called the diffusion of innovation, which is basically like the study of how technology adoption happens, we've been trying to understand what characteristics are really necessary for early adopters to be successful so that they can help sort of reframe the narrative and serve as models that can be replicated by other folks.
So as I understand that model, you find early adopters by finding people who really can benefit by even early versions of a new technology, where the new technology is so much better than what is available to them that they'll pay a lot extra sometimes because it meets needs that they have right now. Is that a reasonable summary of what that strategy entails?
Sort of. So it's looking at all of those conditions might be more open to nuclear or advanced nuclear because they're already paying a lot. So, you know, if you've got really low energy costs, the idea of adopting a technology that's going to drive up your overall cost may not be as appealing. The political and policy conditions. So this is one that I think we've got to be really careful about, is you might have a place that has really great economic conditions for technology adoption, but they have poor policy and political conditions. And that creates a dynamic where you might be able to get a project going, but then you're going to run into significant hurdles that can drive delays and cost overruns. And so it's like, okay, you've really got to think through what are the political conditions. And, you know, getting some early successes in places that have good political conditions can also help sort of influence in a lateral way, because really states and governors and state legislatures and mayors, they constantly learn from each other and benchmark from each other. So we see policy change happen with this sort of like lateral influence network a lot. So it's important to, you know, get the success and then use that as fuel to drive further political change.
Yeah, one of the things I think many technologists don't understand is just how often mayors and governors of various places get together and talk about things, share successes and failures.
Yeah. So, for example, Rod, if you look at renewable portfolio standards, both the adoption of the policy and the adoption of the technologies, it follows this pattern across states where a few states that had really ideal social, political, and economic and geographic conditions, especially for renewables, because you've got to have the right wind, solar, you know, sort of conditions for success there too. They were able to stand up projects early and create models that then they could share with their peers who could then tweak those models for their slightly different conditions, but they weren't starting from scratch. We've seen this with clean energy standards across the states as well. There's definitely a process by which this technology adoption happens. And so the more that we can understand that, we can sort of front load resources and efforts in places that have the highest likelihood of success in a way that enables the adoption cycle to succeed. That's the hope. That's the theory.
You got to have some successes. And of course, one of the challenges that we have is the four projects that got started in the U.S., four units, I guess, are all very closely interrelated. So there's not really a sample of what might be possibly able to be done. They all experience similar challenges because they were the same technology, the same people, the same players, and they're not four independent projects. So we need, as you say, some early successes and hopefully more than a couple of individual projects can get started so that we can see how some of them succeed.
Exactly. Yeah, we want to have lots of winners. So, you know, I think another lesson from the past that I think about a lot is how we ended up in this situation where we have just one nuclear product, and it's huge. And the number of communities or regions that can even sustain this technology are few. And so it's like, we really need to, and I think the developers are doing a great job of this, you know, rethink the products for lots of different users, right? Because we want to have many successes, because if a few companies fail, that's fine. But if we get back to where we just have one or two products, that actually puts the whole sector at risk of sort of collapse, which I think is part of what we're coping with right now. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely essential that we don't just go all in on a single technology.
I've got a question. The zero in the title of the organization, I'm assuming that it refers to CO2, right?
That's right.
Yeah. What is the, like, if in the in all of the multiple and sometimes overlapping criteria that people will use in evaluating whether they're on board with something or not, where does CO2 stand in all those criteria as its own sort of standalone criterion for benchmarking any of these projects against one another?
That's a really good question. So for our team, our mission is rooted in the need to be a part of the climate response. We want advanced nuclear to be a part of that globally. We also recognize it's not going to be right for every community, and all communities will still need to decarbonize. So with all of that in mind, you know, there are some communities that highly, highly prioritize low carbon in their policy approach and in their decision-making approach, and others that don't. And what we're trying to do is to create sort of a framework that can adapt to the values of the decision makers and the communities themselves. So we know, like through cultural theory, that a lot of folks who are concerned about climate change are also scared of nuclear, right? So the sort of set of like attributes that contribute to the worldview make you worried about both of those things. So there are places that may really not feel comfortable with nuclear, but they're still going to need to decarbonize. And then there are places that don't think that climate change is a threat, but they're still going to need to decarbonize too. So it's just this really interesting dynamic when you start to bring all of these different factors together that you can kind of find the jigsaw puzzle piece of like, okay, we have all of these factors, nuclear could work really well here. And sometimes it's like an extreme thing, like, you know, really high energy prices or like rural communities that, you know, there's like a single condition that really pushes them over the edge of making them open. But there are also a lot of places that are kind of like more politically moderate places that have really great conditions for the technology. So it really runs the gamut sort of across the full spectrum of who ends up looking like a really good potential adopter.
Huh, okay.
I would seem that in today's climate, it seems like those areas where they really dismiss the threat of climate change are starting to shrink to almost insignificance. It seems like so many places realize that there is at least a risk, and if you have a way to avoid that risk, you should take it. There are still people that certainly reject the idea that we should spend an enormous sum of money for little gain, but they recognize that it's not maybe not little gain, and maybe the sums of money aren't all that enormous.
Right. It's like a hedge. Like, well, if we're wrong, then it's fine. Yeah. No, I think that's right. And there's an enormous amount of diversity in our country, of course. And I know Steve's in Canada, but I think that's also true of Canada.
And so
just thinking, having a framework that allows us to think really flexibly and to be adaptive, but without missing key things, I think is really helpful. And guys, I hate to have to jump off in a few minutes, but I'll try to wrap this up and just share some of our next steps.
At this point, there was an audio hiccup. Susie started describing a database that Fastest Path to Zero has created that describes market conditions in various locations.
Spatial information. So it's like place-based information about the different conditions in different places. And we're working on building a tool for like utilities and companies and decision makers to be able to use, which it won't encompass the whole sort of breadth and depth of the database, but it will more be like a teaching tool for understanding how to incorporate all of these different factors into decision making. And from there, we're working with ARPA-E to make that available to users as quickly as possible, probably within the next year. And from there, we're also hoping to start to expand this framework to be able to think about the export of U.S. advanced nuclear technologies globally, as well as how to apply this framework to the broader energy transition. So we've got a pretty ambitious timeline and set of goals, but you know, we've got a really great team and we're having a lot of fun doing it. So anyway, I'm really grateful for the chance to talk about this with you both. And please, you know, anyone who's listening to the podcast, reach out with questions or ideas or feedback. We are always hungry for that. And yeah, that's it.
Susie, how do they contact you? And just as we started to get to the point we need to pass detailed information where accuracy is important, there was a Skype audio issue. Here's Susie's contact information at Fastest Path to Zero. Email at Sierra Uniform Zulu Yankee Hotel Bravo at Uniform Mike India Charlie Hotel dot Echo Delta Uniform. That's using the phonetic alphabet, which is freely available on the web if you don't know it already.
Thanks a lot, Susie. And
okay, bye, gentlemen.
Take care.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Well,
that's interesting. It's an interesting effort.
Yeah, it sort of follows pretty nicely with a conversation I had a few days ago with Jigar Shaw from Generate Capital and Jake DeWitt from Oklo, because Jigar is a clean energy guy, but a clean energy guy who has focused on solar in particular. He was the founder of Solar City and has been very active in making sure or arranging for incentives to allow solar markets to be created and costs to be driven down by the age-old method of practice. So,
what's this fellow's name again?
Jigar Shaw.
Jigar Shaw. Solar City. This is the outfit that Tesla purchased.
That's correct.
Right.
Okay. Jigar was the founder and sold off the company, and now he's runs a company called Generate Capital, which is a C corporation whose mission is to finance, own, and operate clean energy projects, in particular those that are maybe not as conventional as some might, they haven't really qualified yet for a conventional type capital, project finance and that kind of stuff. They're trying to help technologies like waste digesters and other things that there's some really interesting technological aspects, but they haven't yet been able to build enough inventory to prove to the banks that they can do it and replicate it. So Generate Capital is an interesting group, and their Jigar in particular has always been interested in nuclear, but also dismissed it as something that nobody would let a company like his buy a nuclear project and develop it. Yeah. But once he learned about Oklo and some of the other smaller nuclear plants, I think that there's a realization that the conventional view of nuclear is very limited compared to what the possibilities really are.
I'm experiencing some of that myself. Just up here, I interact with a lot of solar people as you do. And the president of our nuclear association is a former solar guy. Not a former solar guy, he's a solar guy. And he's and has had the same sort of epiphany when it comes to nuclear as a and its place in an effort to combat climate change and to combat carbon emissions and that kind of thing. It's interesting that a lot of that space is starting to revisit their long-held beliefs. I'm just going from what this gentleman has explained about his own sort of personal journey through the area. It sure is interesting to have the sort of amenability in that sort of segment of the clean energy space, because it didn't exist before. What's your sense of their sense? What's your sense of their sense? Solar proponents who are sort of leaning towards amenability to nuclear in some application. What's your sense of their sense of the blockages for raising capital? Like you said, he wouldn't be able to pitch a nuclear project, and why not?
Well, I think in some ways, in many ways, the nuclear industry brought on many of its challenges by focusing only on big central station power plants.
people who are in the solar business are often very attuned to distributed energy, small modular type construction projects. You know, they like having a standard panel size that you can just go buy. There's a bunch of different competitors that sell all the same kinds of panels, and you can simply purchase them based on your own particular specifications and gang them all up together. You can put them on racks, and there's standard inverters, and those are, being interested in that kind of technology is kind of a philosophical thing. People who want to do that, want to, you know, build solar on rooftops, are not interested in big central station power plants that require billions of dollars of finance, the involvement of multiple huge corporations, and, you know, a regulatory structure that allows them to find markets for the output of a huge power plant.
Yeah, it's
now the developers are focusing on much smaller versions of nuclear. Many of the people with the philosophical opposition to very large central station power plants are recognizing now there's a place where they might use their skills and talents.
Yeah, I get the same sense that I'm conflicted about it a little bit, because I think that given the scale of, you know, Susie was talking about sort of a transition to zero carbon, that's going to be societal, and you know as well as I do that this is beyond and way beyond, not just beyond, but significantly way beyond the scale of just current electricity generation. So you're going to be providing heat and transportation power. This is a 2-3-fold expansion of electricity in order to provide all that. I don't see the demise of a central station model in that. I see actually an expansion of it. So I'm a little bit conflicted. I do understand the appeal that it has to people who want to scale it down so that it means something to them personally. I understand that. The central station model, though, I don't see as disappearing. I just see it.
Please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the people who are interested in small distributed power systems are going to replace those who are still interested and skilled at very large projects. They're going to be an addition to the applications of nuclear. It's not a replacement. It's not that small modular reactors are going to eliminate the need for large central station power plants, although they may have certain markets where the two technologies will overlap and compete. But there are people in this world who are philosophically and are part of organizations where the big is their skill set, where they want to build the biggest and baddest of something, or the biggest and best of something. You know, baddest in a certain positive sense. But,
I know what you mean.
But and those or the organizations that can do that are still going to exist and still going to be involved. Some of them look at small things as not moving the needle enough for them, not being interesting enough to get their management attention, and that's okay.
Yeah.
There's different managers and different entrepreneurs and different skill sets involved. I think one of the challenges nuclear has had is it painted itself into a very small niche of the overall energy market, when fission could be applicable to a much broader range of markets. You know,
it certainly
why is. Obviously, and I, you know, people know I'm a former submariner. Why haven't people looked at the existence of nuclear submarines, even if Admiral Rickover and his subsequent replacements have protected the specific technology of nuclear propulsion in submarines? Why haven't people said, well, just the existence of those submarines means it's possible to go smaller? And of course, now we are, there's finally people that are recognizing, hey, we can build reactors that can provide heat to a community, or that can provide cogeneration, where they can provide electricity to a commercial park, and then distribute heat among the residents of that commercial park. And that's a completely different model than a central station power plant, but they don't necessarily replace each other.
No,
you know, we still have big cities. We still have a lot of people that just want electricity reliably delivered to their outlets, and they don't really care how it gets there. And there are good, solid models and examples of central station power plants doing that job very well and very efficiently. But there's also lots of other people out there.
Yeah.
So I think it's good. Now, one of the things I invited you to talk about, have you been tracking some of the developments of small modular reactors at CNL and what's going on there?
Yes, the association, which I've done some work for and continue to, has really plugged into the SMR scene in Canada, and to the end, it's had some great success. Like, there's been the you've probably heard about the endorsement of the concept, anyway, the idea of small nuclear reactors on the parts of some of our sub-jurisdictional political leaders at the provincial level, Ontario, Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, and now Alberta, to have the premiers, that's like the governors of those jurisdictions, be as public as they have been recently, like just in this year, publicly in favor of the concept, anyway, of SMRs, small nuclear reactors, to address their energy needs. This is just an absolute game changer. It's a really positive development. We wouldn't have seen this even a year ago. So it may be that there's some lip service there, but just the fact that these premiers no Alberta premier would have been this publicly on board with it up until the current one. And similarly with Saskatchewan, you know, I sit in a jurisdiction right now, Rod, as you know, Ontario, that runs on nuclear power, you know, 60% of our electricity. It's all from Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan has been anti-nuclear, like provincially, forever. And for a premier to come out and be as publicly in favor of decarbonizing on that basis as the current guy has been, that's really very significant. So politically,
I know a little bit about Alberta and why it has formerly been very reluctant to be interested in nuclear because of the oil sands and the oil production in Alberta. You know, there's a lot of people that saw nuclear as a competitor to that. It would seem to me that in the current oil market, people who have resources in the high cost production areas might be close to saying, you know, those resources are never going to disappear, but there just isn't a market for them in anytime soon.
Yeah.
Maybe it's better to stop spending money trying to get them out of the ground, because all we're going to do is lose money.
Yeah.
And maybe we need something else that can be a different source of energy. I mean, obviously Alberta's had a very strong energy business for a long time, but they've got to have a lot of people who are wondering, what are they going to do in a environment where the global price of oil is in the 20s per 20s US dollars per barrel.
And our, you know, number one market, the market that industry, that the entire provincial industry is built around serving, is not even against our product. They just don't need it. And you know, since fracking sort of took over, or not took over, but became as prominent as it has, the price of our product and the incentives for Americans to bend over backwards to get it are just gone out the window. So yes, there's that may be somewhat tied to the you know, newfound amenability in the Alberta political class anyway to sort of look at nuclear. I wondered the same thing as you do about whether the sort of dismissal of nuclear across the board dismissal, not just in as a heat source in the oil sands, but just as power generation in the province, had to do with the, you know, they're afraid of the competition. In some ways, I mean, there's you've got some of the most forward thinking energy companies in the world, in my opinion, in Alberta. And I'm, of course, referring to TC Energy, formerly TransCanada. They're a majority partner in Bruce Power, which, as you know, is our biggest nuclear plant. So that's an Alberta oil company, you know, energy transportation company, pipeline company, the guys behind the infamous Keystone, plunking down serious capital to get into the nuclear business in Ontario. And that's a direction that I could see a lot of those companies taking. If they can be persuaded that they're energy companies already, and if they could follow that model, there's other nuclear plants in similar situations to the situation that the Bruce plant was in the early 2000s on the same continent that are in great need of some sort of. Well, of a regulatory change, but also a source of capital.
I'm thinking of a couple of units out on the coast of California that would be wonderful takeover targets. They serve a high priced market and serve it very well, but their current owner doesn't seem very interested in continuing to operate. And of course, I'm speaking at Diablo Canyon, but then there's got to be some others now. One of the questions I can you explain why Saskatchewan, which is the home of one of the most amazing uranium resources in the world, has been anti-nuclear?
Well, because provincially, the NDP is the Canadian version of what I would guess, what I think you could safely say is the AOC wing of the American Democratic Party. So if you put them on the political spectrum, very, very similar. And that's who is, they trade places provincially in provincial politics with the current conservatives, who are more like Republicans. And so it's a fairly strong provincial political class that party federally and provincially all across Canada for historical reasons has been anti-nuclear. So it's been an absolute dead letter. They won't even discuss it. But the fact that, you know, that current has been so strong that even provincial premiers have shied away from it, with, you know, starting with Brad Wall, who is the current guy's predecessor. That's changed, but that's very, very, very recent development. So why is the NDP anti-nuclear? Well, you know, this goes back to why are center-left progressive political parties across the Western world anti-nuclear? That's a whole separate discussion. But that would explain why Saskatchewan has had that position for as long as they have. You know, uranium exports are sort of important to the provincial economy. It's not their biggest single export, but it's important. It's not like oil, but it's important. So they're not above selling it, you know, knowing that it's going to be burned in reactors in other jurisdictions, but they're just absolutely, up until recently, they're not going to talk about doing it in Saskatchewan, which is a fossil province. They get most of their electricity, as Alberta does, from fossil fuels, mainly coal and gas.
So I guess Saskatchewan's got some local coal mines, or?
Yep. They've got coal plants next to those mines. They burn a very sort of low grade form of lignite. And they've been for forever. Like, this is why I'm so dismissive of CCS. They've been involved in a federally funded CCS project, which, you know, has been putting, you know, a total of 1 million tons or something like this under the ground. But they recognize that in order for them to get, if there's going to be a nationwide phase out of coal for electric power generation, it's going to be either gas or nuclear. So that's what they're facing, and so they're at least hedging their decision by, you know, at least looking at nuclear.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I think that there's some interesting synergies, although it takes some time to understand them and look at them, between people who own coal mines and that kind of stuff and nuclear, because coal is a chemical product that could be vastly improved in value with the addition of some very clean heat to it. The people who have always mined and sold their raw material to somebody else may be very interested in being able to use their raw material in a much more value-added situation and keep the employment and the effort of and the revenue from that activity more local. The only way to do that is with clean heat.
Yeah. I remember that I haven't looked at I don't even remember the acronym now. Next Generation Nuclear Plant, NGNP. The INL thing, the high temperature gas reactor. For a while, the consortium consisted of the industrial consortium that was interested in clean heat. It consisted of DuPont, but also Potash Corp of Saskatchewan, or the whoever in Australia purchased them. Major interest in should this become viable and in come into general use, another industry segment that would be interested in clean heat. So yeah.
So I think right now there is one company that is in this stage, I think the third phase of licensing a micro miniature or micro modular reactor to be built at CNL. I believe that company is Global First Energy or Global First Power, and the technology they're using is being provided by USNC, Ultra Safe Nuclear Corporation. Are you familiar with this product? Because I think they've got a partnership with Ontario Power Generation, if I'm not mistaken.
And they do, and I'm not all that familiar with it. I'm very just sort of passively staying in touch with that. This is when you're talking about advanced stage of what regulation with our regulator. I thought that the most advanced in that direction, like for an SMR company, was NuScale. As a matter of fact, our models of decarbonizing Saskatchewan electricity were based on NuScale because it seems to be about the size that would be perfect for the province.
Yeah, but well, NuScale is moving along fairly well, and they were chosen. NuScale and Terrestrial Energy, I think, were chosen for the demonstration joint effort between the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. But I'm pretty sure that the Global First Power, which actually that's the partnership between USNC and Ontario Power Generation, I'm pretty sure they've quietly moved into application for an actual plant with an actual site.
That could be. I won't disagree. I haven't paid as much attention as I perhaps should have. There's just so many SMRs, and I was thinking that the first, the most likely application of one would be in New Brunswick, which is another province that we've sort of left out of the conversation, but hugely important because other than Ontario and Quebec, they're the only province that has gone nuclear in any significant way. But yes, this would be all of this is quite interesting and be really interesting to see where LPG decides to put or to test one of these. I thought it was going to be at the CNL site, like the Ralston, Ontario, like near the original nuclear power demonstration reactor up in that area.
Yeah, Chalk River site.
Yeah.
That's where USNC is going to be, is at the Chalk River site. Now, New Brunswick is a very interesting situation because the New Brunswick is in a key part of the grid. It has, unlike the Chalk River site, it's got great access to transmission and to markets, like the New England markets of the U.S. can be reached from New Brunswick pretty well. And also there are other places. But New Brunswick Power, of course, has a nuclear plant with a nuclear site, and they have made some significant investments into two companies, Moltex and ARC, Advanced Reactor Concepts, two different styles of small reactors, and they're both moving along pretty well. But those, I think, would be sited at the site of the New Brunswick power station.
Of LePro, just to take advantage of the connection. Right. What is global, the OPG, USNC partnership, what's that technology?
High temperature gas is the basic reactor, but they use the high temperature gas to heat molten salt. So they have essentially a molten salt storage system which separates physically and thermally the output from the reactor from the use of the heat somewhere else. And so the reactor can run at its full power. Although it can handle transients, it's more economical to just keep it running at full power. I think about 40 megawatts thermal, 15 megawatts electric. And then the heat would be used sometimes for use in a process heat application, but also for a steam plant.
Interesting. Well, if it's 15 megawatts electric, how are they making the electricity? So the working fluid is what?
The electricity is made through a Rankine cycle that uses the molten salt as the heat input and then a steam system.
It's
what I believe they're using. Now, they also have some ideas about using the heat from their very safe high-temperature reactor differently. I keep trying to kind of coax them into looking heavily at the direct gas turbine cycle, which is the one that I see as the highest potential. What the heck? Why not copy from your competitors? The reason that gas power plants are so cheap is they have a very low capital cost power conversion cycle, the Brayton cycle gas turbine.
Yeah.
You know, if it's so good for them, why not make it so that nuclear can use it? That's been my pitch for the last 30 years, and
the atomic engines thing.
The atomic engine was a direct cycle, or is in concept a direct cycle gas turbine with heat from a reactor that can produce gas temperatures roughly in the 800 very early stages of technology to the 1200 degree range, 1200 Celsius, which is right where combustion gas turbines like to live.
Yeah.
And if you can make it so that that heat can be delivered to a combined cycle plant, you know, you can just go to all these combined cycle plants that already exist and start evaluating whether or not it's worthwhile to replace the input from burning fossil fuels with fissioning uranium, thorium, plutonium, whatever it is you want to fission.
Yeah.
So anyway, many of the very small reactor developers look to your north as a place where their early adopters might be. Have you done much studying of what the power needs of northern villages might be?
Well, it's a tiny market, but it is 100% fossil today. So from which pick whatever northern community you want to pick, they run on diesel. And in principle, I could see them achieving a far better quality of life if they had a more steady power source that isn't as polluting or as expensive as diesel. And that's, I guess, the rub, because you need to you would need to provide this, and it would have to be, you know, what they call walkaway safe, because these communities are not stacked with people who are engineers who can run these things. It's got to be a fairly fairly low interaction between the users and the source. In principle, it's the only way that the Canadian North and the northern part of and northern remote part of any country is ever going to decarbonize. So in that, like on that principle, and I think Rod, that this is not outside anybody's capability. I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility. I think that this will be the future. It's just, boy, how do we get from where we are today to that future? Because the plan is to, in our sector, is to, and I'm not 100% on board with the strategy, is to roll these things out in that setting. And I think that setting is the easiest way to kill it, if you want to be cynical.
So one of the questions that I have, my understanding is that some of these northern villages with Indigenous or First Nation residents don't actually pay the costs of their current power generation directly. They have a lot of inputs or subsidies from the federal government, merely in equity and quality of life and that kind of stuff. So the diesel fuel is provided with significant support from the federal government. And if that is the case, it would seem that there's going to be a lot of involvement in the federal government supporting a lower cost way of producing power. Of course, you're still going to have to get social license to operate buy-in from the residents of the community, and they need to understand that the effort is not putting them at risk or anything like that, but is giving them a better power system that's cleaner and quieter and more amenable to their natural or traditional ways of life. So it's going to be a challenge. I think, I don't know if you've read much about the Oklo Aurora Power Station, but I think it is in some ways targeted at fitting into that market well. And their model of operation is that the company, Oklo Power, would be the owner operator of the facility and simply deliver heat and electricity to their customers.
Yeah. Yeah, I have casually followed it. I'm not a close follower. I love the philosophy behind it. It dovetails absolutely into First Nations and Indigenous, a philosophy of land stewardship. If you want to get new agey about it, it's a very spiritual thing to do. It's taking an element out of ancient rock and using it and putting it back into the rock. It's really quite it's remarkable in that sense. But yeah, you touched on a sort of the sort of general situation, which is the federal government provides a lot of services and a lot of money to First Nations communities in return for those communities settling on one patch of land and not roaming the landscape, and as part of that sort of compromise, and that's just it's a way of financing this stuff, and it's also a can of worms. If initiative like this came out of the federal government, it would be immediately viewed with suspicion just by virtue of having come from the federal government. I shy away from this stuff, having consulted in that area for a while, way back when, it's a tough area to get into, and each one, like, it's a bespoke proposition for each community, basically, and there's hundreds of communities, and yep. they are poor, and they don't a lot of them don't have potable drinking water, if you can imagine that. And you know, this is where a G7 member and one of the founding G7 members, and we're quite affluent. We've got a standard of living that's second to none, and we've got communities all over the country that don't have potable drinking water. So there's it's fraught with administrative and financial issues that, in my opinion, well, yes, a nuclear reactor would be perfect for these places, a small. And in this model that you're talking about, that Oklo would provide, owner-operator. And again, it's not something that can't be done. It's some changes would have to happen for this to come to pass. For a lot of those reasons, I haven't spent a huge amount of time working out the details of how all this would work. It's certainly interesting and certainly a lot of potential.
Yeah. Well, if it was easy, it would have already been done. But
if it was easy, they would be nuclear today and not diesel. That's correct.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the good thing is that there are thinkers out there who see those obstacles as challenges to be overcome rather than as barriers to hurdles.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a good thing. So, Steve, I think that I'm going to probably close it off here. Would you like to offer any concluding remarks before we do?
Well, I just hope that I'm very interested in how the current crisis, how we come out of the current crisis economically. You have the same one that we do, and we're kind of taking your cue. When I say we, I mean Canada, and you, I mean the United States, are taking your cue for how to financially handle this, the current crisis. I'm really interested in how the nuclear industry comes out the other end, especially the entrepreneurial end of it, and you know, like what we've been discussing, the small novel design side of it. That will be really interesting to see how that sector emerges from this crisis. I'm hopeful that it's that some of the barriers that you referred to are diminished as a result of our having pulled through this. But I guess we'll see. And yeah. What about you?
Well, definitely, I'm watching with deep interest. I have a huge stake in the future as the grandfather of six very interested and excited and intelligent young people. I want them to have a good future. I want us to respond appropriately. You know, infectious diseases are something that have always plagued humanity, and we have to learn to deal with them. They are not thinking enemies of us. They are simply part of the environment that we call Earth.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to deal with them in effective ways. And I think quite frankly, I think most of the world has vastly overreacted in an effort to use air quotes here, keep people safe, without recognizing the hazards of closing down the economy. And it's not, I'm not talking about protecting big business. I'm talking about protecting, you know, everyday people who live good lives, often don't have a tremendous amount of buffer. And, there is an enormous amount of economic activity that is simply not happening. So, when people start talking about creating more money and spreading it out, I just wonder what the value is supposed to be represented there. If people aren't flying, airlines are got expenses that don't stop. If people aren't going to restaurants, you know, there's a whole bunch of small business people involved in that enterprise who aren't performing any services and get they still have expenses going. So I think that there's been some models run where every pessimistic assumption you can think of was made. They thought of them as conservative assumptions. I think of them as wrong assumptions. And I think that I'm a lot of people have soundly criticized my comments that I've been making on this line on Twitter, but I'm pretty confident in saying that many of the scary scenarios will not come to pass. There are certainly going to be people who are harmed. There are certainly going to be hospitals that are overcrowded. But I know for a fact that there are some hospitals who are so unaffected right now that they're sending their workers home early without them getting their normal working hours because they don't have anything to do.
Yes, so. You did mention that. I was very surprised to see that.
I think most people would be because it certainly hasn't been talked about in the media, but it's going to happen. I mean, there are some things in life that can't be ignored, and eventually the truth will be available. And I think it will be that we overreacted, and I just hope that there are people who recognize and take responsibility for that overreacting is dangerous.
Yeah.
Although I don't hold that much hope for that based on events in the past.
And quite recent ones, one that just had its 10-year anniversary. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. All right. Actually, it wasn't 10th. It was 9th.
You're right. It was 9. Good grief. It wasn't 10. Next year will be 10.
That's right.
I forgot how to do arithmetic. An anniversary.
All right. All right, Steve. Thank you very much for your time. And we'll be talking again in the relatively near future, I'm hoping. All right.
Always a pleasure, Rod. Thanks for having me, and stay safe.
You bet. Bye.
Thanks.
I apologize for the audio blips during this show. I hope that I edited it well enough so that you got all the information you needed to get. I will try to do better, and probably will set up some backup recording systems to account for the fact that there are sometimes during high periods of network traffic difficulties when you're on a Skype call. Hope you all are enjoying the renewed interest with the Atomic Show. I'm having fun talking to people and will continue to do so. Take care and stay safe.
There's a way, such a better way today. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today, now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.